This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. In Thousand Oaks, just off Highway 101, outside of a boarded-up building in a suburban shopping center, sit 12 white crosses.
Describe this memorial for someone who hasn't been here.
It's really hard for me to do that. You never want to be at something like this.
That's Brian Hines speaking to KCRW reporter Catherine Barnes. Hines owns the Borderline Bar, Ventura County's largest country dance hall. A year ago tomorrow, this boarded-up building was the scene of a massacre that left 12 people dead, as well as the shooter.
So this is how you would walk in to get to the bar normally?
Yeah, there's usually a line out here on Wednesday nights, but up to the stairs and up inside. So that's the actual pathway.
Borderline has been closed ever since the night of that shooting, and a lot of people miss it. It was a special place for so many. Hines says before that awful night, there were 3,600 other amazing nights while he owned Borderline.
It's one of those things where if I didn't own the bar and there's anywhere else I wanted to be, I'd want to be here. I love this place. I bought the place as an investment when I was 27 because I love coming here, and then here we are. So, yeah, it's hard.
KCRW's Catherine Barnes visited the bar to remember what happened here 1 year ago tomorrow.
A lot of the people who went to Borderline were regulars. They went once, twice, maybe three times a week to have a drink, see friends, and country line dance. Sometimes the bar would have concerts, but mostly it was DJs. The entertainment was dancing. Hines says most nights that 40 by 40 square foot dance floor was packed with people of all ages, smiling and enjoying life.
There was a guy, a shorter guy, used to come in, stretch out his back right in front of the fireplace, walk up to, he was probably 56 years old, and he would walk up and just put his hand out, never say a word. And these like 18, 19, 20-year-old girls would dance with him. He would teach them how to line dance. He would teach them how to two-step, how to slow dance. They felt comfortable. They felt safe, and they would do it. And then they learned how to dance, and next thing you know, they're dancing with somebody else, getting twirled, and then they're married.
Hines started going to Borderline as a kid in the early 90s. He admits he's not a great dancer himself, but even back then, he remembers how much he loved watching the bar bring people together.
I was 16 years old. I'll never forget, like, my parents weren't getting along. I knew they were on the verge of divorce. And we went to Borderline. They came out, and the two of them danced. Like, it was like East Coast swing song. It was so fast-paced. And the two of them just went out there, just laughed and danced and smiled. And they did divorce, but I'll tell you what, they're still happy and they're still friends. And I think things like that, like those memories, are just so special.
Hines was sick and stayed home the night of the shooting. When he got a call from the DJ, he hopped in his car.
When she called and she said there was things going on, we thought it was a problem in the parking lot. I didn't think it was anywhere near what it was, but that's why I was on my way. But I still looked at the cameras on my phone and sped up and got here as fast as I could. And when I pulled up, it was just starting.
He saw Ventura County Sheriff Sergeant Ron Helas right before Helas headed inside.
I was right there. I pulled up, saw Ron. Ron stopped me from going in. I thought it was on fire. It wasn't on fire.
What he didn't know at that point was that at 11:20 p.m., a Marine veteran from Thousand Oaks had walked in with a handgun and started shooting during college country night. Sergeant Helas was shot shortly after he walked in. Hines watched as more than 200 people streamed out of the bar. One of those people was Desiree Edmond. She was a regular who would drive over from Malibu most weeks. Her mom, Carmen Edmond, says her daughter would always text her when she was heading home. She knew something had happened when she got a call instead.
And she said, "Mom, there's a shooting at Borderline, and I could hear the gunshots." And I'm like, what's going on? And my husband, we were in bed, laying down, and he stood up and started panicking, and my husband's not the type to panic, and shaking his hands violently, jumping up and down, and he said, "Okay, we're gonna come and get you. We're gonna come and get you. Are you okay? Are you okay? I'm fine. Right? I'm gonna I'm going to try to get outside. I'm going to try to hide. Just hide.
Edmund says the phone kept getting disconnected as her daughter tried to escape.
At some point, she realized she was one of the last ones out as people were going through the back door. And she realized this later, and she said that she had fallen, that there was a ladder in the back that never was usually there, and people were tripping over it, and she fell and was getting trampled. And she said that somebody picked her up. She doesn't know who it was, but some big guy picked her up and carried her outside, and to this day, she doesn't know who that was.
Hines says he's heard a lot of stories like that, of people helping other people get out, and in some cases, throwing themselves in the line of fire to protect their friends.
I described it before as like kind of a controlled chaos, and the fact that there were so many patrons and so many people here that knew what to do because they were military-based and they'd been trained. I remember there was one patron that was shot straight through, and they brought him over to the gas station. But the way he was carried wasn't someone panicking. He was carried properly, and he was taken care of. They had each leg and each arm, and they brought him over there, and they got him in the ambulance, and he's okay now. I hear stories of people that went back in, and you hear that, and you're like, the people they talk about, you're not surprised.
He knew all 12 of the people who were shot and killed last year. 5 of them were his employees. If I die young, bury me in satin, lay me down on a bed of roses, sink me in the river at dawn, send me away with the words of a love song. Hines says he wants to reopen the bar, but it'll take time and money. It costs $200,000 for a biohazard company to clean everything up, which was paid for by insurance. He says he's gotten estimates of over $850,000 to fix the windows, walls, stairs, and electrical damage. Plus, the building was built back in the 70s, so to reopen means bringing it up to today's standards for disability access, electrical wiring, and health codes. Hines is also working with an architect to redesign the space. He says if they do reopen in the same building, he'd want to change the layout to respect the places where people died and avoid certain triggers for people who were there. Another option is to reopen in a new location, he says. In the meantime, 2 neighboring venues have offered up their space for Hines and his staff to host weekly Borderline Country Nights, one in Agora Hills on Wednesdays and another in Santa Clarita on Thursdays. Baby, in the meantime, in the in-between time, all I do is think about you. Just another hey, weekend's on the way, just another Monday and a Tuesday, nothing left to lose day. A permanent memorial for the victims of the Borderline shooting opens tomorrow at the Conejo Creek North Park in Thousand Oaks. And this Saturday, Hines says he and his team will host Borderline at the Park, right next to that memorial. It'll become an annual event, he says, with food trucks, music, and of course, a dance floor. For KCRW, I'm Catherine Barnes. Getting chairs, but they all know my name. A Coke can, a beer can, it's all the same. I always leave at 11:03. I know what's good and what's bad for me. I could roll through.
Well, you heard about Ventura County Sheriff's Deputy Ron Helas, who was killed when he entered the bar that night. Today, the Sheriff's Office dedicated a sign honoring Sergeant Ron Helas on a 3.5-mile stretch of the 101 freeway in Thousand Oaks. Hundreds showed up earlier today to attend that dedication. We'll be right back. Just another hey, weekend's on the way, just another Monday and a Tuesday, nothing left to lose day. Wednesday and a Thursday look just like the first day. Friday night to Sunday, all roll into one day. Just another day without you. Oh, baby.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Members of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus are meeting in Los Angeles this week, and they have their sights set on one thing: Latinx representation in Hollywood. Now, the House members are gathering with studio executives, actors, producers, and others who work in the film and TV industry. And the dialogue comes as surveys show the number of Hispanic people in front of or behind the camera or microphone at levels much lower than the general Hispanic population. Congressman Joaquin Castro is a Democrat from San Antonio, Texas. He's one of the members leading this delegation over the next couple of days. Congressman, welcome to you.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Back in August, USC and some other groups put out a study showing that that Latinx representation, both on screen and behind the camera at all levels, is much lower, as I mentioned, than the percentage of the general population. What was that the spark that ignited your interest in this issue?
Well, it's something that I've been thinking about for a long time, and it's been a conversation within the Latino community for a long time. The fact that Hollywood is such an industry that underrepresents Latinos in just about every way you can imagine, in terms of diversity in front of the camera, behind the camera. Latinos are about 18% of the population and only about 3% of the people in front of and behind the camera. And what's really, I guess, mind-blowing about that is that Latinos make up about 25% of the ticket sales for films, for example. So they're overrepresented when it comes to consumers. And, you know, and so those two things don't match. And you know, in a lot of ways, and I say this even though I'm a proud Democrat, in a lot of ways, Hollywood and Congress have a lot in common. In Congress, you have every member of Congress that's very individually busy. People's days are 11 or 12 hours long. But the Congress as a whole is not very productive. In Hollywood, what's mystifying is that there's an irony there, too. Hollywood is very liberal individually. A lot of some of the biggest donors to the Democratic Party are in Hollywood, just very liberal folks. But Hollywood as a whole, as a system, is not very progressive at all.
When you go to those studio executives and you're talking to them about this issue, what do you tell them that you're most concerned about? I mean, is it just the lack of numbers in the industry, or is it the depiction of characters? Is there a specific something that you want to bring up?
Yeah, you hit on both of those two. The two main things. Yes, it's the people in front of the camera and behind the camera and what they're doing to advance opportunity for Latinos in those roles, whether it's actor or actress, producer, director, screenwriter, and so forth, executives at the studios, but also the issue of portrayal. And we met with the MPAA, who's actually been very helpful in setting up these meetings over the last month or so. We met with them about maybe 3 months ago now, and I also tweeted this, and it's something that I believe, unfortunately, that the portrayal of Latinos that comes out of Hollywood in many ways is as damaging as the portrayal of Latinos that you see coming out of Fox News at night. For example, that Annenberg study said that of the Latino characters, 28% were portraying criminals. And so there was an interview in the early 1970s, that the famous actor Marlon Brando gave, I believe, on the Dick Cavett Show. And back then he was talking about the psychological damage to Native American children of always seeing themselves portrayed as the bad guys in the cowboys and Indians, the Westerns of the time and before that. And you think about the effect on a community that's growing up and always seeing themselves misrepresented and misportrayed, or being the gangster, being the criminal. You know, and that's true not just of the Latino community. The same could be said in many ways about African Americans, about the Muslim community, and other communities as well. So I'm looking forward to having the conversation of portrayal also.
You're going to have these conversations, and I wonder, I mean, do you incentivize them to do something? Is there, or do you cater to, you know, their better parts of their nature? What is it that you tell them that says, hey, look, you know, this is something that's really important?
Well, I mean, I think there's different, I guess, arguments or points to be made. Los Angeles itself is about 40% Latino, and yet you have woeful underrepresentation of Latinos in the industry. So it's not like you're in the middle of Idaho somewhere, you know, so we want to get into those issues. But also, we're meeting with some other groups that have been great advocates for the Latino community in Hollywood and out of Washington, but on this issue of media and entertainment. And we also want to be helpful to them in helping to empower them to do an even greater job of pushing for Latinos in the television and film industry.
Who pays for a trip like this, by the way? This is Congress, right? I mean, are you on official business, or is this something, are you personally just invested in this?
No, this is official business. It's members of Congress coming to meet with the industry because this is important to the people that we represent. There are 38 members in the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. There are about 8 or 9 of us that will be part of this delegation. We represent districts, most but not all, that are majority Latino and are deeply affected by how Hollywood portrays this community. And the misportrayals and the misunderstandings that are generated because of that misrepresentation. And I'll give you one fact from a few years ago, and I was stunned to come across it, but probably about 3 or 4 years ago now, there was a survey that was asked of Americans. And in that survey, 49% of Americans believed that all Latinos were immigrants. So there is this clear misperception about who this community is, and there's this idea that among a lot of Americans that all Latinos just arrived to the United States. And never mind that people have been in Texas for hundreds of years, for example, even before the time that Texas was part of the United States. And so there is a certain erasure and a certain deep misunderstanding that affects how the Latino community is viewed by the larger American community. And I think Hollywood has to look at itself in the mirror and own up to that, own up to its role and its responsibility in being accurate and balanced about how it portrays not only this community, but other communities as well.
You said official business for your congressional members. Is there legislation that you offer that you try and write up to alleviate this, to mitigate this problem, you say?
Yeah, I don't think any of us has drawn up any kind of bill yet or piece of legislation. And I would say that in terms of at least the work that we're doing, we're certainly not there yet. And it's not our intention to go over there with a heavy hand necessarily. But we do want to see progress, just like many others do.
Joaquin Castro, Democratic Congressman from Texas. Sir, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up, shopping malls are in danger of going extinct, but the companies that own those properties aren't throwing in that Williams-Sonoma towel just yet. You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. Onward with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Remember that enclosed shopping behemoth at the corner of the highway and freeway? A place where you could go get a pair of Kinney shoes, some cheese from Hickory Farms, or an Orange Julius. Even check out a movie.
What's the matter? You look depressed.
I hate working the theater. All the action's on the other side of the mall.
Yeah, but now there's not much action left at the mall. That's, of course, bad news for mall owners who are scrambling to stay relevant these days. Frances Anderton hosts KCRW's Design and Architecture. She's bringing us the story of how 3 malls are trying new things to entice customers to come in. Hi, Frances.
Hello, Steve.
Now, L.A. is a mall town, right? We know that from the movies. We know that just from being here for a long period of time. Amazon and online stores have seemingly rendered those malls obsolete, or many of them anyway. Are they just relics of the past?
Not all of them. Although there is actually a syndrome known as sort of dead mall syndrome. There's because so many malls are being very challenged. And indeed, you just said LA is a mall city. LA was a mall city partly because it had some of the most famous mall designers here, one of them being the late architect John Jurdy. And the three malls I'm going to mention have all had the hand of John Jurdy. So this is three malls in the Southland that are all figuring out how to stay relevant. And sometimes staying relevant doesn't involve shops. So let's start with the Westside Pavilion. That's in West LA.
On Pico Boulevard,
Pico Boulevard. Landmark Theatre's there, still going strong. But portions of Westside Pavilion are going to be turned into a tech complex. Google is going to set up home there. So part and parcel of the rethinking of the malls is how to get people to them, which brings me to another mall that's been going through some changes. That is Santa Monica Place.
Also at the end, near the end of the expo line.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, the kinds of changes that are happening at the mall are very much tied to wooing people from the expo line. ArcLight, which went into the renewed Santa Monica Place, kind of faces out towards expo line. So Santa Monica Place, this was a mall that was originally designed by Frank Gehry. It was given a makeover by the firm of John Jurdy. They took the roof off of what was this very enclosed, typical mall environment. And then what they have done in even more recent years is bring in some the kinds of destinations that you might not have originally found in a mall. So, for example, at Santa Monica Place, very recently was opened a children's museum.
A children's museum?
A children's museum, yes. And this was a children's museum that already existed in Mid-Wilshire. Its founder and CEO, Esther Netter, explained why they decided to go to this odd location, a seemingly odd location.
We needed more space and we're looking for a site that was accessible to all, which includes public transportation. We're right here by the expo line. There's great bus transportation and two city-owned parking lots. And Santa Monica is certainly a place that encourages pedestrian traffic. So visibility and accessibility were key.
So there you go. And there's another mall in San Diego that you were talking to me about in the newsroom. This is a fascinating story.
It's a fascinating story. This is one of the iconic malls of the last 40 years. This is Horton Plaza. It's in San Diego. It was designed by John Jurdy, as I mentioned, his firm, hot off helming the design of the 1984 Olympics. He believed a mall could be a civic, buzzing, crowded, lively space. Horton Plaza was one of the visual triumphs of malls in the world. And for a whole bunch of reasons, Horton Plaza has itself become, I guess, a victim of changes in retail. Horton Plaza now has new owners. It is sitting there kind of almost dead. It's sort of on life support. It is meant to be being turned into a tech complex. The city of San Diego has authorized that change. But Macy's is still there. Mm-hmm. And Macy's has a 10-year lease and doesn't want the place to be a tech complex. And they have sued. So there's a fight going on. Meanwhile, preservationists would love to see essentially this postmodern icon remain. But it is sitting there as people struggle over its fortunes. And meanwhile, that mall, which has sort of yielded the ground to other parts of downtown, which I guess have sucked away the life from Horton Plaza.
And meanwhile, there are other malls, Beverly Center, Westfield Century City, these other malls that are investing hundreds of millions of dollars to remake these places in an effort to keep them going.
Absolutely. And what you'll find in a lot of these places is far more food than you ever found, because they understand that people shop online, but they still want to meet people. So where do you meet people?
It's a gathering place.
They're trying to make them into gathering places. They're figuring out ways to stay ahead of the curve. And that means being creative, or it means your mall is dead.
Which is the key. Obviously, staying ahead of the curve is the key to successful business. KCRW DNA host Frances Anderton. By the way, you're going to keep covering this story, right, on design and architecture.
We certainly are.
Frances, as always, thank you.
You're very welcome, Steve. See you at the mall.
The mall. That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about another anniversary. A year ago this week, the Woolsey Fire burned close to 100,000 acres from Thousand Oaks all the way to Malibu. And the cost to life and property, well, very high. how folks in Malibu are remembering and rebuilding. Firefighters, by the way, just now are doing some work on a at least one acre wildfire in Santa Clarita. This is near the Masters University on Deputy Jake Drive. According to KNBC, about 1 acre for that fire. And we're seeing some evacuations as well. We'll keep you posted throughout the day on KCRW. The folks essential to this program, Jenna Cagle, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Christine Comito, Amy Ta, and Christian Bordahl. We are online, by the way, at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Subscribe to the podcast, please. We'd love to see you there. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your ear and for your time. Have yourself a great day.